But yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Cool. Well, and if it ends up being terrible, we can always use it next week. So
that's fine. Yeah.
Hello and welcome. Hello and happy holidays and welcome to our holiday special. Play Christmas music here. What do you mean it's all copyrighted? What? Oh, okay. Never mind.
We'll make up our own.
Yeah.
Happy Christmas, happy holidays.
Dang. I thought it was around. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off there.
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine.
All right. So this Christmas / holiday / whatever episode, we've decided that we are going to give each other the gift of a television show. So they are not random for the giver, but they are random for the givee. No. Receiver. Receiver. That's
yeah, the
receiver. So we've also decided that we're going to try to give something that we wouldn't necessarily normally watch, but we might like or at least find interesting. Right. So, Nos, you go ahead and prepared what your gift to me is. I have no idea what this is, Scout's Honor. Tell me what we are going to be watching.
Okay, well, let me just box it up real fast for you. Kaboing! All right, Nos gotta give it to you. I'm gonna do it. All these times that you've been waiting and you've been putting it aside for so many years now, you gotta watch the first episode of The Sopranos, baby.
Okay. Yes, I have never seen an episode of The Sopranos.
He's never seen an episode, and for our first Christmas together, I gotta do it. Yep. I gotta do it.
It's one of the most important TV shows of all time.
You just gotta do
it. I generally don't like anything involving the Italian mafia, and I don't like premier dramas, and I kind of have some weird resentment issues with HBO programs, but that's not the show's fault.
But with that said, I think it's one of those things for Zach and for anybody else out there who hasn't seen it, give it a try. Yeah. Just give it a try. I think it's great for a reason, even if you may not personally vibe with it. Just bask in the interestingness of early 2000s prestige drama.
Yep. So if you want to stop right now and watch the first episode of The Sopranos so you'll know what I'm going to experience, it is available on HBO Max. So go ahead and do that. Mine is going to be on our Random Access Television playlist if you wanted to watch ahead. It's quite the contrast in tone and decades. As I am going to part one of the Hooterville trilogy, the Beverly Hillbillies.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Specifically, the episode, season 2, episode 34, titled The Cabin in Beverly Hills. It is an episode that features a sociology student meeting the Clampets, and as Nos is a sociology student herself going to her master's program in it, I figured she would appreciate it, and it's just a darn good episode of television, at least in my opinion. We'll see if she agrees. It's actually, because the Beverly Hillbillies was essentially one long continuing story, they didn't really do standalone episodes, it's really an episode and a half, so you'd also have to watch the episode Jed Foyles a Homewrecker, at least the first 10 minutes afterwards. To get the story of the sociology student and the Clampets.
That's okay. I'm really looking forward to this, and I appreciate that that you put the nice personal touch in there, and I can't wait to watch it.
Okay. I know we both, by the way, had backups. So what was your backup? It was a Twilight Zone or something, right?
Yeah, it was a Twilight Zone episode, and it is the occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, and I cannot remember off the top of my head.
Late season 5, if you want to watch it yourself, if you want to just see our TV taste when we're not being forced to watch them via computer, these are generally Nos's and then mine as well, and they'll fall in predictable patterns if you know us. That Twilight Zone is streaming, I believe it's season 5, episode 22? I
think you're right. Go ahead. Yeah. Oh, I was going to say, this is absolutely my favorite episode of the Twilight Zone, and I know that both of us have a fondness for Rod Serling and all his interesting literary mastery and
oddly, suspense. I've never seen it myself, but I have been watching The Twilight Zone for the last few years and stopped the episode before. So I almost punched it a couple of weeks ago, just naturally. So,
well, I think this one, no matter how you feel about The Sopranos, I think you should watch this anyway, because it's a great episode. Yeah, exactly.
And maybe you'll do the same with mine, which is a similar vein from the Beverly Hillbillies. It actually aired on the same network, a couple of years different. It is the Dobie Gillis episode, The Big Question. The episode of The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis. I do not have the episode title in front of me. By the way, while I'm looking that up, Twilight Zone is streaming on Hulu, CBS All Access, and Netflix and Prime. For some reason, on everything. Okay. So
it's on everything.
If you can't find it, that's your fault.
You're just not trying hard enough.
The Dobie Gillis episode. It's technically the name of the show was The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis. It's episode The Big Question. It is season 2, episode 14. It's on YouTube, and it is also streaming on Amazon Prime currently, or ShoutFactoryTV.com, if you'd like to check that out. That one I almost went, and it was a philosophical episode. I would love it if you'd watch that as well. Okay, but we won't necessarily discuss it as well, or maybe we'll discuss all four. We'll find out.
Yeah. Hey, this is a big holiday extravaganza, like Hanukkah. There's 8 days. Yeah. 8 days of little gifts and things. Yeah, exactly. So,
but we're not going to force you to watch 8 episodes, though.
No, you don't have to do that.
All right, well, we'll see you on the other side of our intro here, and Merry Christmas.
Happy Holidays!
All right, welcome back to us, and hopefully you, if you watch the episodes. If not, you are going to get the hell spoiled out of you, because we are just going to discuss every single element of these things, the most recent of
which is 23
years
old. Sorry, guys, you're
lost. So if you haven't watched it by now. Yeah, exactly. Most of which is older than presumably most people.
I think we have a pretty good spread of ages of listeners out there.
At most, you know, it's based on our demographics. It's mostly millennial women. Thank you. But so our first one I kind of picked at random. I didn't use our supercomputer this time. We're giving him the holidays off.
He's
actually Muslim, so anyways. Okay, cutting that joke. All right, so our first present of the night, it's the Twilight Zone episode, An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. It was adapted from the Ambrose Bierce, which is hard to say, if I want to say Pierce, short story of the same name. So this was actually not originally made for the Twilight Zone, but it was a short film made for cinema by French filmmaker Robert Enrico, who wrote and directed this. The story follows a prisoner who's about to be hung by Union soldiers during the U.S. Civil War, and you kind of see what happens in his head as he's about to get hung, and then, well, we'll get into it, but he's hung. It originally aired on U.S. television February 28th, 1964. So, Nas, why'd you pick this episode? Why do you like it?
Well, this is my ultimate top number one favorite Twilight Zone episode, and I know I've asked Zach a couple of times, how far in the Twilight Zone have you seen? Have you seen this one? He was like, I don't think I actually have seen that episode. So I'm like, all right, you gotta watch
it. I actually stopped watching it the episode before. It was literally, if I'd watched one more episode, I would have seen this.
Right. And this has been a favorite episode of mine since I was really, really young. I think, I can't wait to hear what Zach thought about it. And it's just, it means a lot to me. And I thought, well, hey, Zach's a tough person to give gifts to. This guy's a tough guy to give
presents
to.
Just ask my wife. I really am.
He really is. So I'm like, well, I'm just going to go with something that I think we'll both enjoy.
Well, I watched it actually with my wife. We both kind of stood there in silence because if you watch the episode yourself, it's mostly silent. It's sound effects and music, and it's really kind of intensely dream-like, which is why I kind of guessed the twist that he was dead and this was a either an afterlife or hallucination or something ahead of time. Especially since I noticed one of the things that I really noticed is I lived on the West Coast my whole life, but I don't like forests with lots of evergreens. I don't think they're that attractive relatively.
Oh, that's
I like
funny.
The forest with all of the birch trees and apples and oaks and everything. So it was just gorgeous wherever in France they shot this thing. It was just...
Oh, wow.
But sometimes it was spring and sometimes it was winter. And I think that was intentional because when he was about to get executed, there was no leaves on the trees. But the second he goes down the river, there's life everywhere. And they sing that weird song, which is almost which is like 90% of the dialogue in the movie or in this episode.
Right. Oh, that's so interesting. I never noticed that before. Good eye.
So this is set in the U.S. Civil War. So at one point you hear cannons going off. So at one point he's running and it's one of the few times he's scared after he thinks he escaped. And it actually flashes back to winter and suddenly he's in a birch forest where all the trees are empty again. But then as he gets closer to home, the leaves, you know. So this is kind of, I mean, it's really artsy. I mean, it really is. It's got all sorts of metaphors. Let me go ahead and play you. There's almost no dialogue in this. There's a little bit of the Union soldiers at the beginning speaking English, I believe, phonetically with thick French accents. It was kind of hilarious.
But
there is this song that they're playing, and underneath it, you can kind of see scenes of nature, scenes of spring, you know, like spiders, really close-up nature photography. Here's a little snippet of the song. I'm not going to play the whole thing.
Living man. A living man. I want to be a living man. And all the world, he moves around. He walks around. He turns around. I see each tree, I read each vein, I hear each bird upon each leaf. The buzzing flies, the splashing fish, they move around this living man.
But that's also 90% of the dialogue or anything resembling dialogue in the whole thing. So it made me wish I knew more about film technique. It's one of those things that catches me.
Interesting.
Where it's hard for me to appreciate it because I feel like I can't appreciate it, if that makes any sense. So it didn't really get me on any sort of emotional level because I was just looking for technique and substance and style. And it's one of those things that I wish I could switch my brain off when it gets to a certain degree. When something gets to a certain degree of quote-unquote artsiness, my brain just kind of gets into this level of just wanting to, like, figure it out like it's a mystery or something. Like, I have to get the symbolism and everything. So I know this was, like, really emotional to you, and my wife got a lot of emotions, but I was just...
Oh, interesting.
But my logical... My brain just went into pure, like... Oh, what does the spider represent or whatever? I mean, not to that level, but pretty close, you know, and it just...
No, I think that's really cool. I mean, that's actually one thing that I know we've talked about in an early episode on our suspense episode, just the way that the Twilight Zone and Rod Serling's, like, suspense show, just how these sort of, I don't know what to call them, horror shows type things. I think that for most of the really excellent episodes, there is a lot of layers. Yeah. You can look at it as artsy. You can look at it as literal. Mm-hmm. You don't have to. There is no right way to look at it.
And that's one of the reasons why it's so rewatchable is because the first time you're waiting for the twist. And then the second time you watch it, you're waiting. You know the twist, whatever it is. And you're rewatching it to look for clues that you missed and symbolism and everything. And I mean, it's like, you know, am I at Shyamalan movies or something? It's
Right. And that's one of my favorite pastimes. I love symbolism heavy stuff. I love artsy stuff. So, you know, I'm glad that you didn't like hate it.
No.
You're not like, oh, this is the most boring thing I've ever
seen. Not at all. It was, you know, and it just, and it was really bugging me because at one point he's running, although it did bug me at one point because it was a little padded at the end. Like it showed him running towards his wife. And they kept getting closer, and then they were suddenly further away, and then they're getting closer, and it's just like, I don't know if you're trying to be a metaphor, I don't know if you just needed to pad things out.
It was like the stock trope of where, like, you know, the person is running with their arms out, and the other person is running with their arms out. It was kind of like
that. Yeah, but like, there's like a drum beat that they use underneath it, and I know I have seen that used in something, and my brain is thinking it's like 80s Nickelodeon or something, like it's like a sketch sort of thing, like a kid's
it's been
hall,
spoofed
sort of yeah
it's
I don't
been
know. It was
spoofed
just,
yeah
it was something very specific it was triggering that I still can't figure out you know a couple of days later. So that we're not gonna give a present we're not gonna give our presents to each other ratings this time. I think that would be a little unfair, but
we can rate them
no,
if you want.
I really don't okay. don't. So I'm just for the viewer here. On to my first gift to Nos. This is an episode of the sitcom The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis, usually shortened to just Dobie Gillis, titled The Big Question. It originally aired January 24th, 1961. So the show is about two high schoolers, Dobie Gillis, played by Dwayne Hickman, and his beatnik friend Maynard G. Krebs, played by Bob Denver Gilligan. And in this particular episode, they're given an assignment at school from their teacher named Mr. Pomfret, just love that name, that asks them,
good teacher name,
whither are we drifting? A very convoluted way to get them to think about life after high school. So I gotta ask, what did you think?
Okay, well, first of all, so I know you've been trying to get me to watch this show for a while. So this was my first introduction to it. Now, this is a time period of TV that Zach is definitely fond of, and I'm not quite as fond of. It's, you know, it's kind of, what year was
this? So
this
was 61, and actually my other pick, Beverly Hillbillies, was 64.
Got it. Yeah, so it's that early, you know, it's the early 60s. Style of show, and it's you know, it compared to a modern show, it's quite slow. It has a slow pace, but that's the most like criticism I'm gonna give it. This was a very interesting little show. There is a lot going on here, and I don't even know if the show people were aware of like kind of the meta narrative they have going here. But I mean, first things first. So Dobie is this clean cut, nice looking, like prep kind of guy. And his BFF Maynard is just this scruffy, jazzy beatnik guy. He's got like a little beard. And yes, it's Gilligan, which I didn't realize until Zach pointed it out. And Maynard is 120% my alter ego. Like, I love himbos, and Maynard is a total himbo, and he's a beatnik, and I loved him. I thought he was great. Just that eternal, I mean, they're supposed to be in high school, but that eternal boyish Peter Pan, never grow up, love it. I love that trope. And so, you know, the point of this episode, like Zach said, was the teacher kind of gave them this, you know, almost like Zen Koan style thing, you know, question to work on. And so Dobie is like racking his brain, like, how am I going to answer this? We got to answer this. And it's like, it's a very slice of life style, you know, style show. You know, Maynard is like, I don't want to think about this. I don't want to do homework. I just want to go home and listen to jazz. I just want to hang out in a record store all day. And I'm like, I love it. I love it. It was really sweet. But on top of that, it was, I mean, I think compared to like, I'm used to seeing like Leave It to Beaver, Andy Griffith, you know, shows like that from kind of this time period. And this was, I don't know. It had a different vibe to it.
That's one of my favorite things about it. Let me go ahead and play you guys a clip of the episode. This is where Mr. Pomfret is talking to the boys outside and kind of giving them a little prodding while Maynard is scarfing down donuts. So
He loves donuts.
He does love donuts.
Pomfrey. Hi, Mr. Pomfrey, sir.
Now, how are you boys coming along on your essays?
Like miserable.
We don't know where to start.
Well, you might begin by writing some ideas about your future work.
Work!
Is that always his response when he hears the word work?
Work!
Does that answer your question, sir?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Pomfrey, what kind of employment do you think we ought to start thinking about?
Good buddy, you'd have to protect me by using them 4-bit words. I know what employment means, and I can take it. It means work.
Work!
Why fight it? Yeah. All right, boys. What sort of employment is most interesting to you?
How about something in the executive line?
Oh, good thinking, Maynard. There's a big demand for 18-year-old executives, especially with beards.
No, we just can't sit around doing nothing. Hey, can we?
No, Maynard. You have to find jobs.
Yeah. Hey, Dobe, you can get a job in your father's store.
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, a fellow likes to make it on his own.
Besides, your father wouldn't pay you.
True.
So what can we do?
I don't know. Get a job in a gas station?
Too dirty.
Factory?
Too noisy.
Construction gang?
Too hard.
You know something, boys?
What, sir?
Somehow I get a slight hint that you don't really want to work.
Work!
Darn it, he's got me doing it.
That kind of gives you guys an example of the kind of the dialogue, which is very strange.
Yeah.
This was actually a slightly atypical episode of the show in that, like, there was that long shot and then they repeat it where they're like walking and they like walk off screen a little bit and they come back down this weird platform. And it was just a very thoughtful episode of a show that can get that way, but is normally more comedic. One of the best things I like about the show, and you can kind of hear a little bit of that in the dialogue, is just how self-aware every single character is. They know their exact flaws. Like, Dobie is not a smart guy. He's generally considered not...
Just an everyman.
Like, he is... It's like his only trait is that people really like him, and that's it. That's the only, like, useful skill that he has. And... we'll get to it later, but the girl who plays the sociologist guest star in the Beverly Hillbillies episode that we'll talk about, she's a recurring character, sort of a girlfriend. So the thrust of the show is that he is trying to find a girl. That's the that's his only real goal in life is to find a girl. He has no career ambitions. He has no like want to be in the corporate ladder or anything. He just wants a wife, essentially. And she is the female equivalent of him. She wants him, not because he's any good, but because they're compatible and she will make him good because she's the smart one, but she needs a man essentially to go forward in life and everything.
Oh my God. But they're high schoolers.
Right.
They're high schoolers.
But he's also, and so he's always going after, unattainable women with the silliest names in the world. Like, The biggest one is Tuesday Weld is in it. This is one of her first things. And she plays a character named Thalia Mellinger. And like the girl we'll talk about later, Sheila Kuehl, her character was Zelda Gilroy. You know, they just had the silliest names ever. And the show was just, you know, just snappy dialogue, characters speaking themselves.
Yeah. I think my favorite part of the episode was at the very end is after, I mean, basically Dobie like says that he's not equipped to answer the question that the teacher posed, but he, you know, poses it in a very eloquent and philosophical way back to the teacher. And the teacher's like, well, guess what, Dobie, you get an A because you answered the prompt perfectly.
Right.
But then at the very end, Maynard is like, you know, is like making fun of the teacher, and he's like just like put his glasses on in a funny way and was like mocking him, like, today we're gonna learn about jazz. I just thought it was super cute. I really liked Maynard a lot.
He's one of the all-time best, and it makes me so mad that Gilligan was the role he's most associated with, because Maynard was so much better.
This is so much, it's so much more thoughtful. One thing that I appreciated on both the episodes that you gifted me was that they were very thoughtful and they made me feel good after watching it, which I don't think you could probably say the same.
Well, you know, thoughtful I can. Feeling good,
probably not.
Yeah.
Probably, but I think it goes to show that Zach, I think, takes comfort in things that are, how to say it, like almost not Hallmark, because that's Ginchy, but like you take solace in things that make you feel good, and I tend to take solace more in artsy, dramatic sadness.
Yeah.
Kind of.
And, you know, I had phases like that in my life, too. We'll probably go back to that at some point and rewatch Breaking Bad or whatever. But, you know,
right.
I'm not like Mr. Sunshine. I have watched these things. My wife and I are currently working our way through Evil, for instance, which is not a happy show. So. Okay. All right. So next we have Noss's second gift to me, the pilot episode of The Sopranos.
The Sopranos, Zach, what did you think? You finally saw it.
Just in case our viewers at home don't know, I got a little thing to say here. Okay. It's one of the most influential TV shows of all time.
So excited.
This episode originally aired on January 10th, 1999. The pilot follows Mafia Don Tony Soprano, who is played by the late James Gandolfini. So he has a panic attack and starts to go see a therapist, Dr. Melfi, who's played by Lorraine Bracco. That's the setup for the episode. Then we get into it. There's a lot of ducks involved. So here's the thing. I'm assuming that of everybody in my audience, they have all seen The Sopranos. Because
I'm pretty sure most of them have.
Yeah. I am one of the few people, too. It's not... The reason why is not that I didn't think it would be good or that I'm too squeamish or whatever. Nope. I don't like Italian mafia stuff. Just on the whole. It's based around a couple of core concepts that I don't have. It's got kind of every Italian mafia thing has that East Coast Italian thing, West Coast guy, never really been out East. It's got the 40s through 60s nostalgia. You know, there's always doo-wop music and Dean Martin. Not my cup of tea. And then there's the intense family bonds, which this kind of Midwestern sort of person that I am never really developed outside of immediate family, you know, mother, father,
right,
brother, kids, wife.
You didn't grow up in an ethnic family.
I did not, no. I have a lot of cousins and stuff, and my mom was the kinkeeper type, so she knew everybody, but it just never clicked with me. And then I never knew my dad's side of the family at all because he had some weird issues with them. But like, for instance, there was an uncle that I never met.
Oh,
even though he lived in the area.
Wow. Right. Wow.
I didn't know that. I guess he had some issues with starting fires, so we just didn't talk about him that much. But anyways, rest in peace, Warren. So generally, like, I've watched The Godfather, I've watched Goodfellas, and I can acknowledge while I'm watching them that these are really well-made movies. But I also actively hated every single character in them. And wanted them to die, especially Goodfellas. Which is another thing, because I also don't, you know, it's all about pride and rage, and those are two things that I don't really feel, at least not in that way, that hyper-masculine way. This was much better for me than Goodfellas or Godfather.
Good.
Because this is a character that has some sort of introspection, some sort of doubt on what he's doing. He's also much more, at least to me, charismatic than, say, any of the Scorsese people I've ever watched. I still didn't enjoy it all that much because
I didn't think you were gonna be head over heels in love, but I was super curious to see what
I really liked the psychiatrist scenes. I'm gonna go ahead and play a clip here now. This is a scene where it's kind of a, I don't know, the raison d'etre or whatever. I've actually never said that out loud, so I probably mispronounced it. I've only ever spelled it before. Of the whole thing, this is him describing basically what masculinity is to him compared to therapy and comparing himself to the movie star Gary Cooper.
Anxiety attacks are legitimate psychiatric emergencies. Suppose you were driving and you passed out.
Let me tell you something. Nowadays, everybody's got to go to shrinks and counselors and go on Sally, Jesse, Raphael and talk about their problems. Whatever happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type? That was an American. He wasn't in touch with his feelings. He just did what he had to do. See, what they didn't know was once they got Gary Cooper in touch with his feelings, that they wouldn't be able to shut him up. And then it's dysfunction this, and dysfunction that, and dysfunction my fungal.
You have strong feelings about this.
Let me tell you something. I had a semester and a half of college, so I understand Freud. I understand therapy as a concept. But in my world, it does not go down. Could I be happier? Yeah. Yeah. Who couldn't?
Do you feel depressed? Do you feel depressed?
Do since the ducks left. I guess.
That part I really liked, the therapy stuff. And I could probably watch an entire episode of therapy without them cutting back and forth. Which is also kind of weird because about halfway through the pilot, it switched perspectives. So it was him narrating everything. And then all of a sudden it switched to real time going forward, which was kind of confusing to me.
I think it was just like pilot snafu. Yeah. On the other hand, there's a lot of surrealistic aspects that come into the show later. Right. So I'm sure there's much dialogue about whether that was an intentional thing or not.
Oh, I mean,
I don't think we're going to
get into it. No, I mean, like the Wikipedia page for this episode was longer than the episode, than the Wikipedia page for Dobie Gillis, which lasted 200 episodes, so.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it was very, very well made. It's just not for me. The only thing I really felt in it was dread. And like, when are they going to go back to the scenes of them breaking some innocent person's legs? So. And while I'm on this rant about mafia people, one of the things, I do actually watch crime stuff, just not specifically the Italian mafia stuff, because I always find their characters so self-righteous and whiny. This is just a thing where they're always like, oh, we don't sell drugs, we're good family people. It's like, no, you still kill innocent people. I like my criminals like Gus Fring. Gus Fring was a guy who knew what he was. He was a criminal. And I guess that goes back actually to the Dobie Gillis thing. My favorite thing in characters is ones who are very aware of who they are. And I don't mind complexity, but I'm just never going to be attracted to it in a way.
That's so funny because I'm the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. I love when characters, I think the best example of this is, you know, my favorite show of all time, Mad Men. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, you know, Don Draper's relation to himself is very ambiguous. He is not sure of who he is.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love it, love it, love it. So I think it's super fascinating that you're like, nah, don't give me that. Give me the straightforward.
Well, I mean, at least with, you know, I don't want everything to be completely straightforward, but just some. I like characters who are more introspective and whatever. And that's why I like Tony Soprano, because, you know, at one point he admits, I don't really like what I do. And I'm like, that one moment was more interesting to me than every Italian mafia thing I have ever seen combined.
I'll give you the straight facts here, and people cover your ears because it might be an unpopular opinion. I like Sopranos far more than I like The Godfather or Goodfellas. I think Sopranos elevates the genre to such a place that makes it not just a myth, not just a legend, but something that's relatable. Yeah. And I love that.
I can definitely see that. And in general,
a
great TV show is
almost
always better than a great movie. Especially, in my mind, especially one of the things that it does better than movies is big sprawling epics. Which The Godfather and Goodfellas were. They took place over years and years with hundreds of cast members and everything.
Multiple parts in the case of The Godfather.
Right, exactly. So, like, they're talking about remaking a Godfather series. And I'm like, that would probably work better for the source material. That, I mean, especially if you're adapting books like that is, or a real life thing like Goodfellas was.
I would be concerned at this point if they did a Godfather TV show, because I feel like I'm not sure if they could improve on what the Sopranos have done already.
Probably not.
That would be my only
probably do the weird thing where it homages both its original self and the things that have homaged it.
And I mean, you know, we'll see when we get there, but
yeah. So that's it for the Sopranos. It's very, very good. You know, I write
just not for you.
I mean, I write these up on Twitter, and I know I said I wasn't going to give grades, but this one I kind of feel so, like, on a pure quality level, this was an A. It had some weird pilotitis stuff, but whatever.
Right.
For me, it's a C+. I'm not even probably going to remember most of the details I didn't already know a week from now. And it's not because it wasn't quality. It's just not for me.
See, I like that. And I like the fact that you can admit that. And, you know, that's good enough for me. And I really do, from the bottom of my holiday heart, do appreciate that you took the time to watch it and to, you know, broadening horizons, even if I kind of figured you weren't going to be that nuts about it.
Well, and I wasn't sure about these 60s comedies either, which gets us to our last one here, The Beverly Hillbillies.
Beverly Hillbillies.
One of the most popular TV shows of all time. We watched, actually, did you watch both episodes?
I did watch both episodes.
So I only wanted to watch one, but we'll talk about the Beverly Hills. So the Beverly Hills, we watched the 70th and 71st episodes of the show. The episode titles were The Cabin in Beverly Hills and Jed Foyles a Homewrecker. Of all of them, these are the ones that are available on our Random Access playlist on YouTube. So these originally aired May 27th and June 3rd, 1964. So on the off chance you don't know about the Beverly Hillbillies, the show was about a family from the backwoods who suddenly became millionaires, moved to Beverly Hills, California, where they had many, 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 many escapades about not understanding modern life. In this particular episode, they're setting up a recreation of their old house in the backyard as a present for Granny, their matriarch there, and a passing sociology student played by Sheila James Kuhl. Kuhl, K-U-H-L, thinks that they are indentured servants and, you know, gets into it there. What did you think, Nos?
Okay, so this is actually the first time I have ever seen an episode of Beverly Hillbillies. And it was this, I mean, I was always aware of the show. I don't remember it necessarily being on accessible syndication on network TV when I was growing up, so I don't think I've ever seen
think that if it did, it might have played on like channel 58 at like 2 p.m. on weekdays or something,
right, one of those little blocks. So first things first, this is the perfect gift for me. This show is the perfect gift for me. This could have been made yesterday. Okay, so like I don't need to go into the whole plot, but basically, okay, well, so, you know, I'm not 100% sure about all the intricacies of why the Beverly Hillbillies are on this man's land in the first place.
So it isn't. It's actually their house. That's the point, is they're on their house. But so the thing is that she shows up. She's trying to interview millionaires on some sort of sociological experiment.
Just like for an essay, she's trying to gather data. And then she comes across that this, you know, kind of downtrodden looking family is living on this millionaire's land.
Right. But she doesn't know that it's actually their land and that they're very rich, but they're still dressing like they're from the backwoods. And in this particular case, they recreated their cabin, which doesn't have running water, which doesn't have electricity, as kind of a gift from back home, back to Granny's birthday, even if she thinks that she's been murdered at the beginning of the episode. But
that was really, really funny. Yeah. And so the sociologist, as some sociologists are apt to do, while she was collecting data, she misconstrues the entire situation, thinks that the millionaire is keeping the hillbillies as a serfdom, mm-hmm. like that they are underpaid, starving, suffering, and she takes it on as a plight to help this family break out of the shackles of poverty and basically seize the means of production.
Yes. Let me go ahead and play a clip here. This is when she's standing out and Jethro is coming out to grab water, the drinking water. He's actually grabbing it from the swimming pool, but they don't address that. Right. as they call it, the cement pond. She has brought her sociology professor with her to kind of show him that she's not making this up. So there's that clip.
Why, it's even worse than you described it.
You know they didn't even have fire until today?
Incredible.
How can the Drysdales sit up there in their million-dollar mansion eating store-bought, butcher-cut, paper-wrapped meat while their servants live here eating grass?
It's a throwback. It's 100 years of civilization down the drain.
Howdy, Miss Jenny.
Oh, hello, Jethro. This is Professor Graham.
Howdy.
Oh, hello, Jethro. What's that you're carrying?
Well, drinking water.
Don't you have water in the cabin?
Mr. Drysdale never had it hooked up. We're fixing to die of thirst. Come on inside. It's Granny's birthday and we's having a square dance.
Isn't that magnificent? Starving, dying of thirst, and they can still dance.
The flame of the human spirit is hard to extinguish.
Inspired by courage like that, we shall lead these people to freedom.
Go ahead, Granny!
And she is delightful. This actress was adorable. And again, this could be a plot in something from yesterday, like attacking like the woke people or something. Like, you know, she's in all her passion and drive for learning and wanting to be, you know, an apt scholar, she misses the whole point of what's going on. And it's so poignant. At some point when I teach some intro to sociology class, I want to show this episode.
There you go.
Because it's such a perfect example of how you can have the best intentions as a researcher and you will never know the full story of what's going on. You will only know what you as a researcher can see. And it was just done beautifully. It was just beautifully illustrated. It was funny. It was cute. It was just like a really, for me, it was very feel good. It was like, oh, I get it. And I liked, so Zach only originally wanted me to watch one episode. And I wanted to see how it wrapped up because they sort of have the episode style where like one plot will lead into the next
episode. In the weirdest way, because no show had ever done it before and very few have done it since, the Beverly Hillbillies was essentially one long thing where if they had two episodes worth, they would do it. If they had 2.5 episodes worth, they would, because essentially she disappears halfway through the second episode because they're done with that plot and they're going on to the next one. Yeah. And instead of trying to stretch it out to 25 minutes, they just stop it and go to the next one. And episodes will just end sometimes and you'll see it the next week. It's really it strange. It
really
structure.
Reminded me of how, I don't think you've seen this, but how the Mr. Show on HBO, the comedy sketch show, their episodes, they don't have it where it rolls over into another episode, but they have the sort of setup where one thing will lead into another really artfully. Mm. And I love that. I thought it was so creative and not, again, it's something you don't see in modern comedies, how creative this show was. I thought it just, yeah, it really blew me away.
This was by far the number one TV show when it started to air, to the point where I found a list a few years ago. And if you look at the top 100 most viewed things of all time, there are still a half dozen episodes of this show in that list.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Easily. I can easily see it. I mean, I think one thing that, you know, again, not getting too sociological here, but clearly, so the Beverly Hillbillies are hillbillies. That's right. The point of the show. They're very happy to be that way. They don't really want to change. Yes, I guess in, you know, with 2021 goggles, you could say like, well, you know, these people were victims of the Depression and they, you know, whatever, et cetera, et cetera. I don't need to go into all of it, but it is what it is. There's not a lot of moralizing. There's not a lot of, you know, this is how things should be or shouldn't be. It's very take it as it comes. And I really appreciate the authenticity of it.
I mean, one of the things that I think gets misconstrued about this show from people who have never seen it or kind of have vague childhood memories is that that people think that they were making fun of the hillbillies, but it was exact opposite.
Yeah. I think they were making fun of the people in LA.
Right, exactly.
Like, this was, and that's why I kind of like the authenticity around it, is they were especially in this episode, I mean, she absolutely was supposed to be a student from USC or UCLA, and clearly, and, you know, she's this little, you know, budding communist.
Yeah, I mean, at one point, budding hippie, they're dancing, and she says, dance, dance in the master's cabin, dance to the revolution, or whatever, and it's just like...
Right, and it was so well done. It was so before its time, and I hope that girl, whenever she graduates and she becomes a hippie and joins the Manson family or whatever, you know, I hope she does well.
Funny thing about that actress, actually, this was one of the last things that she did. She eventually dropped out. So she was semi-regular on Dobie Gillis. The rumors are that they found out that she was a lesbian, so one of the things that they did was back then, if you got a spinoff, you were not allowed back on the show. So they filmed a spinoff for her that they never had any intention of showing, just to kind of get her off the show. And they did also, that's a rumor, I don't know. She was on another couple of shows that weren't very successful, one season shows, so she quit acting. She changed her name back to Sheila Kuehl as opposed to Sheila James. And then she eventually started running for office, and she is currently the city council member for West Hollywood, I believe, or someplace in LA. Well,
holy crap. And I assume she's like kind of more progressive.
Well, I mean, it's LA. You couldn't get elected otherwise. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That's so funny. Wow. Well, that she took that praxis and she ran with it. That's
much.
Wonderful. Yeah. I really enjoyed her. I thought she was such a talented, like, I mean, as for, you know, a bit character, she really came alive.
Yeah, she was great when she was on Dobie Gillis too, so.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry that she dropped out of acting, but I imagine she can probably make more of a difference being a council member.
Yeah, I think she's much happier without it. She does occasionally, she has actually returned to it, but just to do Dobie Gillis reunion shows. So,
Okay. Wow. Well, that's really cool. I'm really happy to hear that. That's the best present.
All right. Well, there we go. Well, Merry Christmas. Happy Kwanzaa.
Happy holidays.
Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah.
Yep, that was my next one. We'll see you all sometime early next year with brand new episodes, our season two, whatever the computer has picked for us this time. We don't know.
It's a mystery, and we're looking for
it. I mean, it's an old computer. We're in the process of resetting it right now, but that takes three technicians in about 2 weeks, so I couldn't tell you what the next episode would be about if I wanted to.
Yeah, it's just going to have to be a surprise. You'll find out.
All right. Happy New Year. See you next year.
Bye, everybody. Thanks for tuning into this episode of Random Access Television. And if you haven't already, please remember to subscribe to us on Apple and Spotify podcasts. We also love to read reviews, so go ahead and leave us one. You can find us at RATVPod, that's RATVPOD at twitter.com. And if you have questions, complaints, compliments, recipes, email us at ratvpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Bye-bye.
Merry Christmas!
I'm Dr. Timothy Johnson. Later on Nightline, it's a controversy about life and death. Do you keep a doomed baby alive so its organs can be used to save the lives of others?
Stay tuned for Julie Andrews and The Sound of Christmas next, followed by Truman Capote's Emmy-winning classic, A Christmas Memory, starring Geraldine Page.